Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Darkman by my favorite Darkman, JB.
Darkman. No, wait, that's the movie Raimi wanted to make. But he couldn't he couldn't get the rights.
Yes. For the rest of the podcast, I would like you to call me by my superhero name, Darkman.
I could do that.
You can visit our website at fthismovie.net, and you should. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You can like us on Facebook. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie, but it's only our past, I think, 99 episodes. We have over 200. To find them all, you have to go to fthismovie.net and click on the podcast tab.
You should do all of those things. You have nothing better to do.
Do them right now. Listen while you do them and multitask.
We command you.
So we're going to be talking about Darkman from 1990 on the show tonight.
And very quickly before we start, I just wanted to try something because so many people were so nice to point out that with all of this new technology, we sound a lot better.
Yes.
And in fact, I discovered that if you own a Roku, and I recommend that you buy one, it's fun, you can also access the podcast on a Roku. So I'm sitting there canoodling with the Roku, which I believe is a euphemism.
Yes.
And I'm listening to the Seven podcast, and I'm marveling at the quality of our voices. So just indulge me for 30 seconds. Hello, I'm Michael Wingate, and this is Thomas Reinecke, and this is National Public Radio.
We did this joke already on the, me and Mark on RoboCop.
You're kidding.
We did the NPR joke already.
Okay, did you do this? Thank you for joining us for What's Up My Nose.
No.
For the next hour, Thomas will try to guess what's in my nostril.
That we did not do.
On NPR. I'm sorry I haven't listened to RoboCop yet.
That's okay. You saw the movie. You know what it's like.
I do know what it's like. I do know what it's like. I'm behind in my listening.
That's okay. Hey, before we talk about Darkman, Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
I have, and it's Serendipity. That
you saw Serendipity? It's not that good.
I'll start again.
They both want to buy the same pair of gloves. That's a movie.
Oh my God, I barely remember that movie. Last weekend, I finally saw Nonstop.
Yes.
And I loved it.
All right.
I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought the script was really tight. It played all the right games. It didn't cheat. It kept you guessing. It was well directed. It was even better written. And it was just a good time.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a masterpiece, but I felt like I got my money's worth. And it stars Liam Neeson.
And sort of fills the Liam Neeson first quarter slot ever since Taken was such a big hit. Every January, it seems like we get the Liam Neeson movie. So we get Taken, and then we get The Gray, and then we get Unknown, which was not any good.
Was that the one with January Jones?
Yes.
Oh, I saw that. See, I discount that. To me,
same director, I believe, as Nonstop.
To me, the Liam Neeson, my wife tragically died, so I have to work constantly to get through the grief trilogy, is Taken, which I also enjoyed.
Yeah, sure.
Wolf Puncher,
right,
which is what I now call that because you came up with that. And now Nonstop. Nonstop is a nonstop thrill ride, Patrick. Please put me on the poster for the Red Box. I went in with very low expectations, and I just... Parts of it are like a Hitchcock movie. It's so well done. It really plays the game fair.
All right.
And I'm not used to that in movies that are modern.
Right. Anything besides Nonstop?
No. In fact, I'm way down for the year. You know, I keep this list. And for some reason... I have not been to as many movies as usual.
I have not either, and I chalk it up to being busy, but also I feel bad, but I don't feel like I'm missing a ton of stuff. There hasn't been a lot of stuff that has come out that I thought, oh, I really want to get to that, and then just never did. I'll see Nonstop now. And I think things maybe are going to start picking up. I'm not dying to see Divergent.
No, that just looks like everything that's right. Popular.
Young
with
adult,
young,
the movie.
Yeah.
And
I'm looking forward to Muppets.
I mean, I am in theory, but I don't think any of the trailers look good.
There's a couple. Well, the idea of an evil Kermit is kind
sure.
of, that's interesting. And
sure.
Of course, Grand Budapest, which I'm just waiting. No, no, we've talked about this before. I am a much bigger Wes Anderson fan than you are.
Something has literally broken inside me.
Oh, yeah. Because
I used to really be a fan, and I'm not kidding. When that trailer comes on, I feel irritated now.
And I was talking to our very own Adam Riske on Sunday and sort of comparing notes because he's seen it already, and we were talking about our favorite Wes Anderson films.
Right.
And his are very different than mine.
Okay.
But it was really nice to hear someone singing the praises of Moonrise Kingdom. Because most of the people I know, well, you're pretty much the only person I know, that by Moonrise the spell had worn off and people were like, okay, well, more of the same.
I liked Moonrise Kingdom better than I think his last couple. Darjeeling Limited to me was really the one where it just felt like, okay, we're kind of coasting now.
I thought Darjeeling was sort of him phoning it in, if that's possible. And I don't know a lot of people who like Darjeeling, but... And it wasn't my original reaction, because like most great films, it kind of spun my head around and I had to figure it out. And it took me a while to come around. But I'm a really big fan of Life Aquatic.
Really?
Yeah.
I keep waiting for that to happen to me because I'll rewatch it every couple of years and it hasn't happened yet. I think it's interesting in the way that it feels different from some of his other movies, but I
different
still don't
love
it.
Different and yet the same.
Yeah, well, sure. I still don't love it. I don't know.
Riske said that if anything is a bid for, at the very least, one of his films finally winning an Oscar for art direction.
Oh.
Come on. Is there any other film on earth that's more that Budapest might be the one to take? Right. To take the gold. Because in F This Movie, we take the Oscar so seriously.
The title belt.
We're all about Oscar.
And then in a couple weeks, we get Captain America, which I'm... pretty crazy excited about, and I'm mostly sick of superhero movies, but
Captain America,
I think that one looks really good.
The first Captain America is a film that just grows in my mind when I think about it, and occasionally I'll catch a piece of it on cable, and I'm like, damn, why don't they make more of those? More CA, fewer Thor.
But this one looks a lot more like... It seems like they're trying to do like a 70s kind of paranoia thriller.
Yeah.
Which sounds cool. I don't know. I think the trailers for it look really good. I'm really excited about it. I finally saw Blue is the Warmest Color, which I did not get around to seeing last year. And it's available on Netflix Instant now if you are interested in seeing it.
And can I be uncharacteristically candid and ask you,
sure,
did it give you a boner?
Here's the thing. It's a 3-hour movie where everything basically takes place in real time. And the sex scenes... Okay, so the movie is famous for having these really graphic lesbian sex scenes.
Which later the actresses somehow disingenuously claim they were tricked into.
Well, no, I think they just said it was sort of an awful experience to shoot the movie.
Oh, okay.
By the time, like, the third one comes around, I really was just like, ugh, this again? Like, 15-year-old me was punching adult me in the balls. Like, stop saying that! But it really, I feel bad. It grew tiresome because it wasn't giving us new information. It wasn't showing a growth in their relationship. It was literally just like, and they're fucking again. There's a lot to like in the movie. The two lead performances are good, and there's, you know, the way it sort of charts this romance is interesting, but boy, it could have been shorter.
I know it played at AMC, I think, for a week.
Yeah.
And I thought about going, but the thought of...
When are you in the mood for that?
Theater, other people,
right.
And then the Blu-ray came out, and then Criterion... somehow shooting themselves in the foot, announced that down the road, the better one would
come. Oh, really?
So the one that just came out is bare bones.
Yes.
And there's one coming out with supplements. And I just figured I will wait for the supplements.
I guess, but I don't feel like I need to see the supplements. Two other movies I'll talk about quickly. I finally saw The Counselor, which I really wanted to see when it came out last year and wasn't able to. And then grew even more interested to see it because the reviews were so crazy, mostly bad, including one writer for Salon, who called it the worst movie ever made.
Oh my God.
But I just thought with Ridley Scott directing and Cormac McCarthy writing and that cast, I really wanted to see it. So I finally did. I watched the extended director's cut because it's Ridley Scott. So, you know, the version that came out isn't the one he wanted to make, which runs about 2 hours and 20 minutes. So I can't comment on the theatrical cut, but, it's interesting. There's a lot of stuff to like. It kind of reminded me of Killing Me Softly from the year before, where it's like, there's a ton to like in this. I'm not sure if it all comes together. Some good performances, some very uneven performances. I have been, I suppose, a Cameron Diaz apologist for several years, but she appears to be out of her depth acting alongside Javier Bardem and Michael Fassbender and Brad Pitt doing one of his great character roles.
All of this makes me want to see it because I know when Killing Me Softly came out, it was sort of, I don't want to say litmus test, but it was sort of the realization that you and I, my friend, see so many movies that we want something different.
Right, right.
And the majority of people don't.
Right.
Because they just don't see as many as we see. And I remember the way my audience in the theater reacted to Killing Me Softly, which was not...
And I fully understand why audiences would reject The Counselor in a big way. Why critics did to such a crazy degree is a little bit more puzzling. I'm not saying the movie is a masterpiece. I think there's a lot to like. I think it shoots itself in the foot a lot of times. Cormac McCarthy's dialogue is obviously very stylized, which can... There's an adjustment. There's a scene maybe halfway through the movie or two-thirds of the way, and this is not a spoiler, where Michael Fassbender has this conversation with Ruben... I always said it was Ruben Blades, but I believe it's Ruben Blades. You know who he is. And
he's still alive?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So they have this long conversation, and it's fascinating. It's this philosophical discussion about the two worlds that you live in, the one that you wish you were living in and the one that you're actually in. It's sort of this conversation about facing the reality of your situation. It's really interesting. It goes on for a really long time, and the problem is it happens over the phone. And so I just kept thinking if they were sitting in a room together, this would be not to the level of Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper, but it would belong in that conversation. It's just the dialogue is so interesting in that scene that it would be such a memorable scene. But instead, it becomes this interminable thing where Fassbender's just sitting listening on the phone while Ruben Blades gives this really interesting speech. The movie is full of stuff like that. Fassbender goes to buy a wedding ring, and the guy selling him the ring literally talks to him for 10 minutes.
Wow.
It's interesting in the way that it...
Could Scott have been doing that on purpose to sort of, well, this is sort of an anti-movie?
Was exactly the thought that was going through my head, that it's almost designed
that he's playing with you
to punish you. And there's other things that it does that I won't get into, but yes. And to go back to Cameron Diaz real quick, her performance is a problem in the movie. She's required to do some heavy lifting. And then I guess when she recorded the role, when she filmed her scenes, she spoke with an accent. And then they watched it back and said, that doesn't work.
Oh, boy.
And so she had to redub all of her lines. And I wonder if the problems with her performance are perhaps due to that. I don't know.
And that always improves a performance. Just ask Andy McDowell.
Well, at least she got to redub her own lines.
No, I'm thinking of Greystoke.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Cameron Diaz got to redub her own lines. Andy McDowell was redubbed by Glenn Close.
You're one step ahead of me.
And the last movie I'll talk about, which I just wrote something about very quickly on the website, which is I just saw Knight Riders for the first time.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, the only remaining George Romero movie I had never seen. And I really loved it. I thought it was really, really... great.
No, I like what you said about it, that it's the film that makes you wish he had made more non-zombie films.
Well, and watching it, I had all these ideas about what a personal movie it was and how George Romero is really the Ed Harris character and he refuses to sell out. And I really thought I was onto something, right? And then I watched an interview on the Blu-ray where Romero basically says as much. And then I read one review today that also... So everybody picks up on this fact. My observation is nothing special. I thought it was really, really great. A little long, but I really loved the performance of Tom Savini. And he shows up in a bunch of movies doing kind of character parts. And it's always like, hey, great. Ha ha. There's Tom Savini. He's Sex Machine and From Dusk Till Dawn. But he does a lot of acting in Knight Riders. And he's really, really good. It kind of made me wish he had acted more.
Every year, I show the documentary The American Nightmare to my class, which has sort of replaced Fear in the Dark, which you remember.
People think it's strange that I can eat a plate of spaghetti.
Folks, I cannot tell you how accurate the impression he did just was. In fact, at a recent Comic-Con flashback weekend, I bought a bootleg DVD of the VHS. So scared was I that I would lose the ability to play a VHS. But besides Professor Tom Gunning from the University of Chicago, everything that Savini says in that documentary, all the Vietnam stuff,
yeah,
just transfixes my students. He is a great guy, and he does a lot of shows.
Yeah.
And I've had some interesting conversations with him at shows.
He has a reputation for being prickly at conventions.
Which is what I used to initiate a conversation with him the last time I...
Savini, I heard you're a real dick.
No, I didn't say that. My son had told me something.
My son says you're a real dick.
No. My son had seen something on YouTube, and I sort of used that as a conversation starter, that at another convention, some guy was trying to talk to him about Vietnam. And Savini wasn't having any of it, and it ended with Savini saying, well, then you don't know shit. And that's what I used to begin the conversation, perhaps hoping that he wouldn't say that to me. But Savini does a lot of cons, and Savini, in my opinion, is great. Oh, by the way, it's the pause that refreshes.
Okay. All right, so let's move on and talk about Darkman, Sam Raimi's superhero movie from 1990.
Yes.
J-Bones, you, when we were talking about doing this, you had said that you don't think you had seen the movie since 1990 when it was out.
I'm now sure.
Okay.
That that's the case. So watching it again was really, really interesting, and my memory of the film was flawed.
Okay.
I remember kind of liking it.
Okay.
I liked it enough to buy the action figure, and I just realized I meant now that we're in our new digs, I can't just point to the wall. I was going to bring the Darkman
action
figure.
You don't actually have to like the movie to buy the action figure. You own plenty of action figures for movies you don't like.
No, not very many. Maybe
really?
One. Not a fan of...
You have several Friday the 13th action figures. You don't like any of those movies.
But it's iconic. I watched it again. This would have been Sunday night, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But found it a mixed bag.
Yeah. That sounds about right.
And I was hoping that's something that we would talk about, because
yes.
I sat there like trying to unravel it. It's very much an independent filmmaker who wants to be a mainstream filmmaker.
Okay.
And I saw Darkman as the transition between the Evil Dead films and the later films. And by that, I mean Spider-Man, not stuff like A Simple Plan.
Right. But there's a full 10 years of movies in between those two things, you know?
Between
Spider-Man doesn't come around until 2002. Darkman's 1990. So there's 12 years in between.
Okay. And between Darkman and the first Spider-Man, what is he making?
A Simple Plan is in there. I think The Gift might be in there. For Love of the Game, The Quick and the Dead, Army of Darkness. That might be all of them.
Well, that's interesting then. Then chronologically, my theory does not hold water. I'm a big fan of A Simple Plan.
Me too.
I think it's a nice piece of work. So maybe instead of it being a transition, it shows that he can go back and forth. Because,
right,
of course, Army of Darkness has all of that. I'm going to call it Three Stooges stuff.
Right, right, right.
That I don't think Darkman needs, and it's like he can't quite get it all out of his system. It's also, and this might speak to the fact that he had big problems with the studio.
Yeah.
And the studio had problems with the script, and they had problems with the shooting, and they had problems with the casting, and they had problems with the editing. I guess the editor had a nervous breakdown or something.
I read that, but yeah.
That it's very much a film of individual sequences.
Right.
And they vary wildly in tone.
Yeah.
And he's not very interested in transitions, because the film sort of lurches from one set piece to another.
Well, it feels very, maybe this speaks to the issues with the editing, that it feels short. And, you know, so many movies feel long, but this one clocks in at about 90 minutes, and it feels like a lot of stuff was taken out.
Right, and it feels peppy, because I remember reading an interview with the Coen brothers, and of course the Coen brothers worked with Raimi at one point. And the Coen brothers went on and on about how they like films that are peppy.
Right.
And don't waste your time. So you get that opening sequence with the gangsters.
Right.
The Larry Drake character horning in on the other guy's action. And that is, it seems like that was very carefully worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an okay action sequence. I really liked, spoiler alert, the hidden machine gun in the guy's leg, especially the Raimi-esque detail of the guy having to hop.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
After the fact, it's very funny.
Yeah, that's very nice. And then, this is almost like what you said about the RoboCop remake, though. Darkman can't quite figure out what it wants to be.
Okay.
Or maybe more accurately, he thought it could be these three things.
Well, yeah, I think it's the kind of... And one of the reasons I really like the movie, and like you, it has big problems. I kind of love it because the stuff that works, I think, really works because it's so much a Sam Raimi movie, and just as a big fan of Sam Raimi, I love it. And it feels like he sort of snuck something by, that the studio hired Sam Raimi and then was surprised when he made a Sam Raimi movie, and then Universal puts this movie out that looks nothing like anything else out at the time. Where was I going with that? Oh, just that he clearly loves this thing and this thing and this thing, and so badly wants to sort of smash them all together.
Yes.
And it never gels. So at any given moment, you're like, okay, well, this part's a Universal Monster movie. Okay, this part's a comic book. But it's never necessarily all of those things at one time. Sorry, hit the mic.
The three pieces seem to be a standard 90s action film.
Right.
With gangsters and gunfire and chase scenes and action sequences.
Right.
And then another piece of it is a Universal horror film. I actually think it's most successful when it's doing that.
Yeah.
But I might think that because that would be the part with Liam Neeson. And I really think Liam Neeson is good in this.
Okay.
You disagree.
No, I think I do too. I gotta backtrack a little. But go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, let me qualify. Because the minute you pause, I have to start searching.
I do think he's good.
I think he's much better as the monster than in the love scenes.
Yeah.
And the love scenes, for me, don't work at all.
No.
That someone decided that this could be a tragic hero on the order of Phantom of the Opera, which it sometimes resembles. And then we get these very uncomfortable love scenes, one of which takes place at a carnival. And then another part of it is a comic book movie.
Right.
And when it came out, that's one of the things that the critics liked about it the most. In fact, one of them said it was the most successful comic book movie he had ever seen, which is ironic because there's no comic book.
Right.
So maybe there's four pieces: action movie, monster movie, romance, and comic book movie. And it's a weird mix.
His heart clearly lies mostly with comic book movie and monster movie, which is why some of the action doesn't work and definitely the romance doesn't work. So in 1990, we're one summer out from Batman. And of course, I'm 12 or 13 and Batman is the biggest deal to me. And I love Batman. It defines my life at the time. So I spend the next year or two chasing the Batman dragon.
You said, you would draw the logo.
Right.
On everything.
And out comes Darkman. I don't know anything about it. I don't even know who Sam Raimi is at the time because I'm too young and I haven't seen Evil Dead and I haven't seen Evil Dead 2. So his name doesn't necessarily mean anything to me. But it's this superhero with bandages on his face, and I'm a monster movie fan, and he's jumping and helicopters are chasing him. So I'm super excited to see it. I want to go see it opening day 1990. I don't have the money to go. I think I remember spending the whole Friday shoveling rocks like crazy manual labor because we had these rocks at the bottom of our driveway that we had to take out because the village said we had to, like, that we were trying to extend our driveway and we had to take these rocks out.
Oh my God.
I told my mom I would shovel out all the rocks if I could go see Darkman. So she would have to buy my ticket, drive me to the theater, and vouch for me.
Because it's R.
Because it's R, and I can't get in. So I spend the whole Friday shoveling rocks so I can go see Darkman, and I go see it at like 5:30, and I don't know what to make of it because the 13-year-old me wasn't expecting a Sam Raimi movie. And so when there's all this crazy rear project, all those really Sam Raimi moments, the rear projection, all the crazy stuff, I don't know how to process that. I just was looking for a guy in an overcoat jumping away from a helicopter. So there were things about it that I liked, but I think I felt like, and I rarely have had this reaction to any movie, but I remember feeling like that was too weird. And I get older, and the movie has aged so much better than Batman from 1 year earlier. And part of that is because now I've grown up and I'm a huge Sam Raimi fan and I understand what he's paying homage to. And I like the little touches that he includes. And so I've come to appreciate Darkman way more as Batman continues to fall in my estimation. We did a podcast on Batman. You can listen to it.
And I'm just imagining young Patrick in the theater and your arm still hurt. And you're saying during those crazy montages where there's all this stuff on the screen, why did I shovel all those rocks?
Danny Elfman was doing the score. I mean, I really was like, it's going to be Batman again. And it was just weird. It was weird. So part of that, too, was I didn't know any of these actors. Liam Neeson wasn't anybody at the time. He was in a couple things, but I hadn't seen them. Frances McDormand meant nothing to me. I think Larry Drake, I knew who he was because he was on TV at the time, even though I didn't watch L.A. Law.
Playing a very different character than the one here.
Which they clearly cast him as after seeing his life-changing turn as Bubba in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow.
And he's actually good enough in Darkman that I forget that he's in that. He's sort of embarrassing in the Scarecrow movie.
Oh my gosh, yes. Oh my gosh, yes. He is great in Darkman. He gives my favorite performance. So none of these actors mean anything to me. And I think part of my reaction to Liam Neeson, who I think has gotten better with age. I think he's better now than he was in 1990. I think he's a better actor.
Yeah.
I think part of sometimes the way that I react to him watching the movie even now is somewhat colored by the 13-year-old me reacting to, I don't understand these choices. And why is he using that weird voice? And now I like him. And I, like you said, I like him better as the monster than just as Peyton Westlake. But I think the casting is one of the big problems with the movie.
Well, Raimi wanted Campbell.
Yes.
And that would be a very different movie.
Yes.
And Universal said no, because he wasn't a big enough star. I think Frances McDormand is an interesting choice, and I have to think that had something to do with Raimi's association with the Coen brothers.
Yes.
And I think she works as a lawyer. I believe that she's a lawyer.
Yes.
But I don't think the two of them have any chemistry together.
Not at all.
So actually, when her evil boss, spoiler alert, says that you should get over your grief by dancing at that function.
Yes.
And they dance.
Yes.
I thought they had as much chemistry as, and it was like, oh, he's, this of course is before we know just how deep he is.
Right.
That it was sort of this nice gesture to dance with her, but they have three or four scenes together. The weirdest one being at the carnival.
Well, but that is my favorite of the scenes because that culminates in my favorite line in the movie, which is take the fucking elephant.
Which is a very Raimi thing. My favorite part of that sequence, though, is the fake skin that makes him look like Liam Neeson again starts to burn off.
Right.
And he's literally smoking and running back to the factory, and he holds on to the elephant that he's dragging the elephant.
But even his reaction when the skin starts to bubble is so weird and cartoonish. I have a hard time getting a handle on his performance. You mentioned the scene where she dances with the boss, and the boss is an actor, I want to say Colin Friels. And I also believe he is not a good, he's not a good villain. I don't like his performance. I don't like him as a villain. I think Larry Drake as Durant is really great, and this movie kind of tries to play the RoboCop game where we have the villain on the street, the Clarence Boddicker, and then we have the villain in the boardroom, the Dick Jones. And the villain on the street is great, and the boardroom villain kind of sucks.
It's supposed to be this big revelation when you discover, oh, they're in cahoots?
But, like, how much of this comic book horror movie action film really should be revolving around a memorandum? The number of times they say, "I see you saw my memorandum."
And there's this funny
ridiculous
name, the
Belisarius memorandum.
Belisarius memorandum. It sounds like the name of a Robert Ludlum novel.
After I watched the movie last night, I watched a couple of the special features on the Scream Factory Blu-ray. One of them is an interview with Frances McDormand, and she talks a little bit about the... She kind of butted heads a little bit with Sam Raimi.
Yeah, that's what I read.
And she even says, near the end of the interview, which I think is really interesting, she's miscast. She recognizes that she was miscast in the movie.
Oh, so it's not just me.
No, she appreciates the opportunity, and she was very determined to not play it as sort of the typical damsel in distress.
And does not.
Right. So she says it's interesting. Her performance, her participation in the movie makes it more interesting because of the way that she chose to play the part, but she says that she's miscast. And I thought, well, Frances McDormand just nailed it. There's nothing I can say that she didn't already get right. Because, yeah, none of the stuff with her, I think, works. Her as a lawyer, I mean, it's not that she's bad when she's playing a lawyer, but it's just not interesting. It's not compelling. I'm not concerned for her safety. And there were a few other names that I guess were floated around. Julia Roberts was one, and then got cast in Pretty Woman and dropped out.
That would be a different film.
Ellen Barkin was one. Demi Moore was one. And it's impossible to say, would the movie have been better with any of these other actresses, because maybe they would have played it more in sort of the operatic style that Raimi was going for, and maybe it would all feel like more of a piece. So while I agree with Frances McDormand, what she's doing is different than what we usually see.
Very different.
I think
it's not what the material calls for.
Exactly. I think it sabotages the movie a little bit.
That first scene in the apartment,
they're doing the slideshow?
Yeah,
okay.
They have so little chemistry together. And then later the next morning, they have so little chemistry together that when he follows her down to the street and says, "We should get married," it's jarring because it's like, oh, I thought you were brother and sister. Certainly that's illegal.
And even her reaction, it seems
I
hadn't even considered that as a possibility. And then 15 minutes later, it's this timeless love story where all that's important to him is protecting her and coming back to be with her. But it's like, no, a few minutes ago, she thought she was startled by the fact that you would even consider proposing. It also feels like you had talked about them dancing. And then later in the movie, when he does come back, he says, "Did you fall in love with someone else? Is there someone else?"
Because when she dances with the evil boss, he's spying through that grate. He sees that.
Right. But her response is like, well, there was another guy and he comforted me, but it meant nothing. Surely a bunch of stuff got cut out, right? I mean, there seems to be a whole subplot there that
because
was
a little
lost.
Bit later, he makes a reference.
He, Liam Neeson, or he, the boss?
The evil boss.
Okay.
That they have started a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, none of that comes across.
And all that gets cut because that makes the Frances McDormand character a lot less sympathetic.
Yeah, right, but we have to get back to the memorandums and the coffee stains.
But you were dead. I went to your funeral. By the way, for people who are fans of this, the first shot in the cemetery?
Yes.
There's the Liam Neeson tombstone with Westlake on it.
Right.
And right next to it, there's another tombstone.
Yes.
It's got the name of the production designer on it. My wife noticed that.
Apparently, there's lots of little things all throughout the movie. The car that shows up in all Sam Raimi's movies does show up during, I think, the helicopter chase. And supposedly, in that car, or in one of the cars on the street, is the Coen brothers. Who reportedly did some punching up of the screenplay.
He calls the car the classic,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
And it's in all of his films. Speaking of them dancing, and then later she dances with the evil boss. And again, this is something my wife noticed. And I don't know what to make of it, but I think it's interesting, and we can talk about it for a minute. How much doubling there is in the film?
Yeah.
That there are certainly instances where Darkman pretends to be someone else, even to the point where the actual character and the Darkman Mank are in the same shot, most notably when he's Larry Drake and they're both in the revolving door.
Right.
But there's other things in the film that repeat. For instance, when he kills Sam Raimi, he raises him up through the sewer grate into traffic.
Ted Raimi, are you talking about?
What did I say?
Sam Raimi. That's okay. I just want to make sure. Yeah.
Ted, the brother.
Right.
When Darkman raises Ted Raimi up through the sewer grate into traffic to do away with him. And then later that's reversed when they lower Darkman into traffic. That's not one of the best examples, but there's a whole bunch of things that happen twice.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I thought it was. When the lab goes up and Westlake is pitched out of the lab into the water.
Yeah.
Later that's mirrored when little bald Ratso, evil assistant, gets pitched out of the his apartment by Drake. But of course he's not lucky enough to land in water.
Right.
My wife had a much better list. I'm trying to remember them. But there's a whole bunch of things that happen twice, and I wonder if that's deliberate.
I would imagine so. It doesn't sound like that kind of thing happens by accident.
If only on a script level, like the carpentry of the script, which I talk about sometimes.
It seems like the movie works best, or that Sam Raimi is sort of most invested during a lot of the revenge plans, that he really likes the stuff where Darkman pretends to be other people, which, I mean, obviously is the whole appeal of the character, that he can wear these disguises and trick the bad guys into killing each other off or whatever. My favorite disguise gag, I think, comes late in the movie when he's wearing double masks. So he wears the one, the guy takes it off, he looks like Liam Neeson underneath. So he kills him, only to find out that was a mask,
too. Yeah, there's duct tape under that mouth, and then he removes the second one.
That's my favorite of the disguise gags.
And I really like, because I think we've talked about this on other podcasts, that if characters are indestructible and have no handicap or no Achilles heel, then they just bat each other around the screen and we're not invested. So there has to be obstacles placed in the way of our hero. And the whole 99 minutes thing, I think is very, very cool.
Yeah.
And sort of adds a dash of drama. Oh, he's got to do this, but he's got to do this in a certain amount of time. I thought the whole thing when he's in the hospital and we get Jenny Ogwitter's little cameo and John Landis's little cameo to remind us what a great film American Werewolf in London was.
And supposedly that was supposed to be Kathy Bates. I read somewhere, and she bailed out at the last minute, and Landis said, you should get Jenny Ogwitter.
And she's really good.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting because I always considered her in the roles that she plays to be very sympathetic. And yet she has
awful
dialogue
where
she's
right.
just this horrible, unfeeling person. And another one of the doctors is Raimi.
Yes.
Under the mask.
Yeah.
So that whole sequence seems designed to set up something that they later sort of cheerfully
abandon.
The
thing that he can't feel pain.
And that this will make him feel isolated, and it sets up the anger management problem that we then later see at the carnival.
Right.
But I'm not sure if they need any of that. This guy destroyed your body and blew up your lab.
Right.
So why can't he just be pissed about that?
The anger management thing, I agree. I don't think it's that necessary. The can't feel pain thing, I agree. They don't really do anything with, except for when he accidentally lights his hand on fire and
that's
it. They took my hands.
And I thought that was interesting because that harkens back to Evil Dead 2, give me back my hand. That Raimi seems to have something.
Well, just look at the opening when he's clipping the guy's fingers off with the cigar cutter.
Hand trauma.
But it seems to me, it seemed like that was a way of trying to give Darkman another quote unquote superpower. That one of his powers is that he can't feel pain.
No, I wish they had explored that.
But they don't I agree, they don't do anything with it.
And also in the hospital scene, they set up that he can have superhuman strength.
Right.
I mean, that's explicitly stated.
Right.
So it's like they're throwing all these things up against the wall, seeing what will stick. I like the opening sequence. I thought it was really well directed. And that's where you get that sort of comic booky atmosphere where every shot is so perfectly composed mm-hmm. that each shot looks like the panel of a comic book. It looks very premeditated. And then near the end, it sort of doesn't fit in this film somehow. The scene where they drag him around on the helicopter on the rope.
Right.
Because Darkman's afraid. I mean, he's right. making noises because he's, you know, he could die. And then in the middle of that sequence, they sort of, I don't even know what the verb is. They're flying around and he goes into an office building and then it becomes comedy for right. 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And then that's
Sam Raimi.
Right. I mean. And then he takes off again. And I thought the helicopter thing actually comes across, to me at least, as anticlimactic, because earlier when they're chasing him across the rooftops.
Yeah.
And they're blowing things up.
Yeah.
And there's all these shots of him jumping in front of that stuff is great.
Yeah. That was all the stuff that when I saw this at 13 that I really liked because it felt the most sort of commercial. It was the most in line with what I thought it was going to be. They built a lot of the marketing around those images because I remember thinking, I want to see the guy with the bandages and the trench coat jumping away from the explosions.
And the way he jumps is very comic book like.
Yeah.
And those shots look really, really good. I know I've read that a lot of people chalk up the film's success to the marketing campaign. And I would have to agree because I still remember the marketing campaign.
Right.
They spent some money. The posters were everywhere. And the tagline was, "Who is Darkman?"
Right. Which is smart because, A, you're introducing a character that nobody knows. So you want people saying, okay, who is Darkman? But also, you know, there really were no stars in the movie. So now you're trying to sell a movie with a character that's untested, a concept people aren't familiar with, and actors that have no commercial appeal at the time.
So they're selling the concept.
Yeah, but I mean, that's hard, and a studio now I don't think would even touch that.
I'm gonna jump ship for just a second,
because right.
I'm wondering if you've seen this, and this is a continuation of what have you seen lately. I only caught the second half. I desperately want to see the whole thing. Seduced and Abandoned?
No, I've never seen.
It's on cable.
Yeah, that's the Alec Baldwin documentary?
James Toback
yeah.
thing. They
yeah.
go to Cannes, and they're trying to get investors
right.
for a remake of Last Tango in Paris.
Right.
But that's not really what it's about.
Okay.
That's sort of the clothesline to hang things on. I don't mean this to be quite as big of a tangent. Most of it is interviews with directors that you really like.
Oh.
Talking about the movie industry today and
okay.
how different it is. And that comes up again and again and again. That film would not be made today.
Yeah.
That film would yeah. not be made today. And like you said, it's a shame because I think we need films like Darkman.
We do. I touched on this a little bit with the thing I wrote on Romero, just that he's not allowed to make movies now that don't have zombies in them. So he has to find ways of incorporating zombies into the movies that he wants to make. And not like Romero was ever given license to do whatever, but when you think about the fact that he got Knight Riders produced, and part of that was because it was part of a deal. He made a 3-movie deal with a guy who said one of them has to be a sequel to Dawn of the Dead. So that's how we end up with Day of the Dead. And the other two that came out of the deal were Creepshow and Knight Riders.
Wow.
So those 3 movies, that's incredible. And he said he had basically total freedom during that time. And
you can tell.
Yeah. And he has no freedom now. He can't even get a movie made. Sam Raimi, you know, I don't want to accuse Sam Raimi of selling out. But when you look at Darkman and sort of how much scrappy personality that movie has, and then you compare it to Oz the Great and Powerful, and just what a soulless CGI garbage that movie is.
And I had almost forgotten about that film because I'm desperately trying to convince myself that Raimi didn't direct
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's like a Sam Raimi movie for the first 5 minutes. But
have you seen any of the sequels?
Yes, I've seen them both. I don't remember them particularly well. I think they're fairly well regarded in terms of being direct-to-video sequels.
Major spoiler. The first one is called The Return of Durant.
I don't remember how he...
Yeah, that seems...
I think it's established that he survives the helicopter crash or something, but...
But that's crazy talk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's on par with Hamlet 2. How
right.
is that accomplished?
Right, well, somebody just figured out that Larry Drake was sort of the breakout character in that movie and said, well, we got to build a movie around him.
Does Darkman appear in that?
Yes, but he's not Liam Neeson, obviously.
He's another actor under the
banner. Arnold Vosloo plays Darkman through the second two movies.
And that's... Am I getting this correct?
He's the mummy?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's him.
Oh.
Yeah.
That makes me want to see them.
Jeff Fahey, I know, was in the third one. I just saw him probably a year or two ago. I don't remember them at all.
I was sort of hoping that the two direct-to-video sequels would be bonus features on the Shout Factory
That would
disc.
Be nice, wouldn't it? I bought the Criterion King of the Hill, A, because I've never seen it, and B, because one of the bonus features is the underneath, which is an interesting kind of failure.
Speaking of Criterion, we just found out yesterday that Hard Day's Night is coming out, and I was looking, thanks to Cameron Clothier, and one of the bonus features that I always thought should have been on the previous ones, although, to be fair, I already have Hard Day's Night on Blu-ray from Canada.
But you said this on the podcast that they should have included.
You can't do that. Yeah. The making of A Hard Day's Night, which is amazing and magnificent. And I think it's in Lester's contract that every single version of Hard Day's Night has to include the running, jumping, standing still film as a mascot. But one more thing, because I went to the Criterion Collection website to see what the bonus features were. And I was very excited about this. And of course, like every website, people are allowed to comment.
Right.
And it impressed me. It impressed upon me just how damn old I am. Because someone commented, at last, I never thought this film would be part of the Criterion Collection. And you know what I was thinking?
What?
That was one of the Laserdiscs.
Oh, right.
They've actually put it out before. Right. In the golden days when young people stayed off my lawn.
When movies cost $150.
And we liked it.
We had to get up and flip it over halfway.
In my house, that's when we went to the bathroom.
Back to Darkman.
Yes.
One of the things that I love about the movie now is all of those crazy... You know, it's such a director's movie because the screenplay is problematic, because the performances are uneven. I think the casting is troublesome. But Sam Raimi really comes through his personality as a filmmaker. And one of the things I really like is all of the crazy rear projection shots and all the kind of special effects that he does.
And I love that, too. I'm going to agree with you, but halfway.
Okay.
All of the pans, all the homages to Universal, and a lot of that is... the montages where there's more than one thing going on on the screen. At one point, there's this crazy, good Lord, where's my filmic vocabulary? That it's double exposure and he's working on something and there's
all this
crazy crap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that adds to it because that's what it's supposed to be. But all of the sort of cheap slapstick sped up stuff.
Okay.
I don't think it has any place in this film.
Yeah. Like, which stuff are you talking... Like, when he gets mad and it goes into his eyeball and all that kind of stuff?
No, that doesn't bother me. There's some stuff where someone's walking and they suddenly show their feet all sped up.
Okay.
clearly, it's toned down from Evil Dead.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's still there. One thing I actually like, and I wonder, is that... Was it in the script? Did Raimi come up with it? This is another example of the doubling I was talking about earlier. At one point, the Darkman character is very frustrated and puts a funnel on his head.
Right.
And $5 to see the dancing freak. $5 to see the dancing freak. And Liam Neeson commits. So, I mean, it's genuinely... odd and disturbing.
Yeah.
And then later at the carnival, as that scene fades out, we hear the barker saying the same thing.
Right.
That I don't think pulls you out of the film, but there's just a couple little Three Stoogey moments that he just can't get out of his system, which is odd because they're gone in A Simple Plan.
Yeah, well, that's a very...
Did someone sit him down?
No, I mean, that's a very different movie for him. And they're way toned down in the Spider-Man movies, even though I think a lot of... He comes through a lot in those movies, but I think it's way toned down. I mean, in Spider-Man 2, it's really just the scene where Dr. Octopus sort of comes alive for the first time and the tentacles attack in the operating room. And that's such a Sam Raimi movie. And then he makes Drag Me to Hell and sort of brings it all back, you know, and that movie's super fun. I like that movie. But yeah, Simple Plan obviously showed that he could do something different. Then he made For Love of the Game, which you can't even tell is a Sam Raimi movie. The thing is, I mean, I like all the rear projection and all the kind of optical effects that the movie uses, but sometimes they kind of pull me out of the movie. And so on the one hand, I'm thinking at the end when they're on the steel beams and Frances McDormand starts to fall and he grabs onto the cable and he swings down and catches her. And that's great because it's this iconic moment from every, you know, everything. Then it cuts to, you know, shots of them just clearly in front of rear projection screens. Yeah. And obviously, I think that's a practical decision more than an aesthetic one. So I like the artifice of the effect because I just like that kind of old-fashioned optical effect. But at the same time, it pulls me out of any urgency of the moment because
Cause
no one's in danger at all.
There's no stakes.
Right.
And the film almost takes pains to explain it. Because once again, we get the myth of the talking killer where he explains that he's very comfortable many stories above the because his father put him to work as a welder with Apache Indians who apparently are employed for this purpose. But here was my problem with that sequence, and maybe it's because my son played Mortal Kombat as a youngster. Raimi specifically shows us at the bottom of the not yet completed building a literal bed of enormous sharp spikes.
Yeah.
This is the gun in the drawer.
I got a feeling that that got cut.
You show me that and then you don't. What?
And it being Sam Raimi, I have to believe that he shot that, but I that probably got cut. Again, it's amazing. Going back to what I was saying about kind of being pulled out of it, the helicopter scene is another great example because you're watching it and it feels like two movies happening at once because in the wide shots, it's this amazing stunt of a real stunt guy hanging from a cable from a helicopter and it's incredible. And then it cuts back to Liam Neeson in front of a screen and it's like, well, I like the one thing and I like the other. Sorry. But every time they switch back and forth, it's jarring. It jerks me out of it. Again, I think it's amazing that this movie got through, that Universal put it out, because I was thinking about what you had said, and I'm sure I have to believe Sam Raimi shot that and they cut it out. But Liam Neeson, I can't believe that Universal allowed just the Dark Man makeup in a movie that in their, you know, it wasn't a hugely expensive movie. I think it was like $15 million or something, but that's in $1990. But this was a summer movie for them, you know. The Dark Man makeup is so grotesque.
Yes.
And the fact that that is allowed to be on screen as much as it is, I have to applaud the movie.
It's a great makeup. And I also applaud Raimi at this point because we are very gradually introduced to it.
Yeah.
The reveal takes a long time and it pays off. I mean,
But he spends the whole end of the movie.
Oh, sure.
In that makeup. I mean, he's not bandaged anymore, you know? So I think it's, I mean, I won't say, you know, it's a miracle that this movie exists because it's obvious that Universal was kind of taking a gamble and hoping that they would have a franchise, you know, that they would create their own superhero, which is even better than what Warner Brothers had with Batman because they would own that, you know?
Oh, you bet.
And obviously the movie did well, I think it did okay here. I actually think it did really well overseas. Like, I think it ended up making over $100 million.
I believe it.
When everything was said and done. But it never really made much of an impact here. It's definitely sort of a cult movie that has caught on, you know, especially once it hit cable and everything. But it's one of these movies, you know, superhero movies are now so prolific. And there's three or four a year. And next year, 2015, I think we're literally getting them on the same day. That's the big news now, that Captain America 3 is coming out on the same day as Batman versus Superman. And so which studio will be victorious?
Oh my God.
And who really cares?
It's not a sporting event.
But I find myself drawn to some of these kind of also-ran superhero movies, like Darkman, like The Phantom, with Billy Zane. I'm a big fan of The Rocketeer. I know we've talked about before.
And we've talked about The Phantom. The Phantom is so much fun.
The Phantom is great.
And as I said, I think this was a year or two ago, can you imagine if Mystery Men had just been released a couple of years later?
Yeah. And I get Mystery Men, we're both big fans of Mystery Men. It still has problems. It's over 2 hours, and it has no business being over 2 hours.
I have far fewer problems with Mystery Men than Patrick. There's more to love.
No, I'm a big fan, but that's another example of one. I have not yet rewatched The Shadow, and I don't think I've seen it since the day it came out. Shout Factory just put that out in a special edition as well.
Is it out already?
It is. It just came out a week or two ago.
I love The Shadow when it came out. It's got Jonathan Winters, and I think this was right after I kind of set up the first time I really had decent sound.
Okay.
Where I watched film in my house. Because I've told the story before. Jake and I were watching Die Hard, and the scene on the roof. We heard gunfire, and we both turned around in the family room to see the bullets.
Yeah.
That the sound design in The Shadow when he's clouding men's minds is really, really cool.
Okay.
I think it's worth seeing the movie just for that.
I'm excited to revisit it because I haven't seen it in almost 20 years.
It's not as good as The Phantom.
Yeah, my memory of it was that I didn't love it. I don't know, but again, Darkman to me has only gotten better over time. And I think like you, not to speak for you, never love it quite as much as I want to.
Which one?
Darkman.
Oh, okay.
There's stuff in it. Watching it last night, there's stuff in it that I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so great. I really love this. And then every time we get to like a boardroom scene or any scene with Liam Neeson and Frances McDormand, stuff gets in the way of me really loving the movie.
Well, like I said, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
There are individual sequences that are amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, it just makes you think, what if this was more of a piece?
Right.
And the entire thing was like these four scenes.
And is that just a function of Sam Raimi being sort of a little boy whose interest isn't held by the scenes where people just stand and talk to one another?
Well, here's a suggestion, and you're right. The worst scenes are the scenes where people just talk because there's no action for him to storyboard or direct.
Right.
And I don't mean to play remake the film, but it makes sense for Neeson and McDormand's first scene to be in the apartment and it's day and it's morning and stuff. But after he's scarred, why would you have any of their scenes together during the day? You put them at night in the dark in his environment, and they're instantly more interesting. Even if the dialogue was the same, that one little change, I think, would make a difference.
Well, and they have
really... He's Darkman.
Right. But they have... Well, because they want to set up that whole ticking clock thing.
Right.
Because it's just... It's like the two scenes, right? It's the first time they see one another again in the cemetery, which, to your point earlier about them being brother and sister, they're reunited after she thought he was dead, and it's like... Oh, hey, you're here. I mean, yeah, it's nothing. It's not.
The Coen brothers should have polished that scene.
John Goodman would have just shown up. and then they have the scene at the carnival, which I kind of like because that's really the only scene in the movie that speaks to the anger management issue and that really plays up this idea that he's a freak.
But again, and I don't want to remake the film, a carnival visually is more interesting at night.
Sure.
That whole thing with the freak would be kind of different.
Sure.
That entire carnival thing would work better at night.
And maybe honestly, it's just Universal saying, you have to shoot some of this during the day. You can't do the whole thing at night.
And clearly, you're really not going to get away with showing a carnival day for night.
Reward.
That would be technically odd.
And again, I got to give the movie credit for the way that it ends. It commits to the bit. And he leaves Frances McDormand and disappears into the shadows and turns into Bruce Campbell, and he is Darkman. But
was that an attempt by Sam Raimi to posit Bruce?
I don't know.
For the sequels?
I don't necessarily think so. And I don't even know if it was deliberately to set up a sequel. I think whether or not you know there's going to be a sequel, that's the end to this movie.
The audience I saw it with, I still remember this, the audience I saw it with in a theater was so hip that at the end,
that's
when
great.
Bruce showed up,
there
was an audible...
That's great.
Yeah.
Because it took me, you know, it was probably not until my third viewing that I knew who he was enough to say, oh, right, that's Bruce Campbell, because at that point I had finally caught up with some of the other Sam Raimis.
Remind me again. I'm going back to you shoveling the rocks, which I feel sorry you had to do.
No, that's okay. It was worth it. I got to see Darkman opening day.
1990, how old are you?
I'm 13.
Okay.
Yeah. But even before the disappearance and, you know, I think more than anything, it was just a way to get a Bruce Campbell cameo. I love that he drops the bad guy and says, I'm learning to live with a lot of things. It's a great last line. And there's none of this bullshit where the hero tries to save the guy, but, you know, he just always slips through his fingers. I was almost a good guy, but he's still dead, so we can all sleep at night. It's much more like Man of Steel, where he just straight up murders a guy. Darkman, I expect it. Superman, less so. But I think the ending really works. And if you can stick the landing, you know, I'll always leave a movie feeling pretty good about it.
And on the whole, there's, I don't want to give the impression, there's a lot more to like than there is not to like.
Yes.
So if you have not seen Darkman,
we've ruined all of it for you.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, that's fine. Maybe if nothing else, I think hopefully this will inspire somebody who saw it and maybe didn't like it to revisit it, give it a second chance, and perhaps reassess it.
I think after listening to this, you could go and watch it for the first time.
Well, I mean, chances are you knew that Darkman was going to win and the bad guys were going to die, which is basically all we spoiled, I think. And the Bruce Campbell cameo. Sorry
and
about that,
Frances
everyone.
McDormand is miscast.
Oh, right. Oh.
There's all this doubling. And
oh, and that whole thing about the counselor? Sorry, guys. Anyway, that's our wrap on Darkman. Thank you guys for listening. And thank you, JB.
You're welcome. This has been National Public Radio.